This is the Oil Sand Tech Podcast with Aaron Shearhart. The oil sand industry is the largest unconventional oil business in Canada. And on this podcast, we'll be interviewing people who are building products and building services that can improve the oil sands. We tell the story of how to build products and bring them to market. The Oil Sand Tech Podcast. And now, Aaron Shearhart.
Technology. I'm happy to have met you and have you on the podcast today. So tell me a little bit about neighbor research and how did you end up here today?
Okay, well, basically Green Neighbor Research is, it's green, and Neighbor stands, N-A-B-R, which stands for Non-Aqueous Bitumen Recovery. We don't use water, we don't use cave, we don't use pressure. It's a solvent technology. It's basically two ways you can mobilize bitumen. While it's in formation, one of the ways is using steam and heat. It's quite expensive, uses a lot of water. And the other way is for a solvent technology. We use a solvent technology. Problem with solvents is you put it in the ground and it stays there and it doesn't go anywhere. If you push it, it's going to go to places you don't want it to go. So what we do is we use we have an ultrasonic tool that's surrounded by the solvent in formation, and turn it on, and it basically activates the solvent, raises the diffusivity by about 3 orders of magnitude, or 1,000 times, and that way it penetrates into the bed quite quickly, and it mobilizes the bitumen, so it can then be extracted.
So take us back to 1979. How did you first get involved in oil sands research, and what has been your kind of some benchmarks along the road? So you've seen the technology really move from, a technology in its infancy to being a commercial entity here, supplying a good portion of the world oil supply. And so maybe you could take us down that road.
It's quite interesting. Basically, the AOSTRA project, which is by the Alberta government, began around, I would say around 76, 77. And up in Clover Bar, which is by Edmonton, they put in large simulators, which are pressure vessels, filled them up with oil sand, packed them in, put overburden pressure on it using nitrogen gas, pressing down on a plate, and then inject steam into it, see what happened. At the time, they were using twin angles at University of Alberta to log the data and analyze the data, but they didn't have the software. At the time, I was working with earthquake prediction with Margaret Lamoureux at the University of Alberta, so I went over to OSRD, Oil Sands Research Department, and cut the code and cut the software, did the mathematical modeling, basically played with oil sand a lot so that we could get reports out and so forth, which resulted in the AOSTRA handbook. Now, at that time, we figured the sort of break-even point, it all works with dollars. So the break-even point for steam and jet, I mean, we tried everything. We tried solvents. We tried throwing stuff into the solvent stream. We tried electricity. We tried all sort of jumping up and down on it. We tried microwaves. We tried just about everything with it. And so looking at, actually, it's at that time is where I discovered the idea of using ultrasonics, but which in itself won't work, but you need to use a hydrocarbon solvent. Most people used water, which won't work, but if you use a hydrocarbon solvent, it does. So, but they didn't have ultrasonic tools at that time. So steam was pretty well the only thing you could use. And to use steam at that time, we figured that the break-even point was about $22 a barrel at that time. Now, oil at that time was selling at about $15 a barrel. And in 84, it just got shut down. I think that there was a government decision that we'll just leave it in the ground and wait till the price comes back up or the price goes up, and we can develop it then. There were some people who actually injected it into the side of a cliff where there were outcroppings into the side of a cliff and actually got it to work and basically got a SAGD in a, what's known as SAGD now, into the formation there. And that would then, I think, sometime in the mid-80s, early 90s, that went on. But there was pretty well no research at all. That whole thing got shut down, I think, till about 2006 is when actually the oil prices started to come up significantly. And it was like, okay, let's turn on the taps and start going for it. And that's when most of the research started coming in, which was a steam base in any way they can and so forth. The SAGD projects came online in a big way. So it's actually quite new, this technology, even with SAGD, even with steam injection, is extremely new. At that time, in around 2010, I started my company. That's where I got the patents and so forth on using solvents with ultrasonics. We tried a downhole test at that time, and we So we're seeing a range of different things we can use this technology for. So that's basically where I'm at. But over the years, it's been all set by the price. Right now, we're at about $56 a barrel. And I think the break-even for steam injection is about $60 a barrel. And the break-even for mining be at about $40 a barrel. So we're in a situation now where a number of things are going to be shut down as far as steam's concerned. We also have a moratorium on CSS, various other things. So it's a very interesting time right now in what is to be done with technological innovation and research and so forth. We've basically been stuck with just looking at steam, and we have to look for alternative ways, not just from an environmental point of view, but right now we have to look at alternative ways just to try to make some money out of this.
So maybe at this point we can kind of dig a little bit deeper in terms of the technology that you are developing and using the ultrasonics in terms of alternative extraction techniques. And so so tell us more, I guess, in specifics in terms of how does ultrasonic oil sands extraction work?
If we're in situ, it doesn't matter the depth. It can be at shallow depths or quite deep. Basically, you have, let's say, 18 or 20 meters of pay, which is just oil sand for about, let's say, a thickness of about 20 meters or up to 30 meters or whichever. So you drill into that, and then insert a tool at the place where the oil sand is to fill it up with some sort of solvent. You could use contaminated diesel, for example, which is quite cheap. You use frac fluid. You can use just about anything you want, xylene, pentane, condensates, anything as long as it's not water. You turn on the tool, and the sound will not go through the oil sand. Very few things, I don't think anything goes through oil sand. This stuff's rough to get anything through. It doesn't go through it. Steam doesn't go through it. Nothing goes through it. You really push the stuff and so forth. So if you increase the diffusivity, in other words, you activate it in some way, heat is one way to do it. But ultrasonics works extremely well to get it to dissolve stuff through different things like sonar chemistry and shear forces on a molecular level and so forth. So in the interface between the solvent oil sand interface, it starts chewing it up, and you develop a chamber or a sonic chamber in situ, and this ultrasonic chamber starts growing. Now, from results we've had, it goes about anywhere from 15 to 30 meters in about 5 days or 84 hours, is how long we had the tool on, and that's how far it will penetrate, and we can actually get solvent into the bed without having to use pressure, without having to push the stuff, which is quite significant. As far as I know, we're the only people that can do that. And as a result, it would go in, it would clean it out, and we should get somewhere around 60% recovery at least using this particular technology. If you're using steam with a SAGD bed, you can be anywhere from about 6 months up to 2 years to warm up the bed, around a year, okay, 6 months, depending on the bed. So you have to be pumping steam into that thing before you can get a decent return. You can get a return right away, but like to get anything that's worthwhile, you're going to need to heat that bed up 6 months to a year. That's an awful lot of steam. A lot of power has to go into it. Well, we could probably get recovery within about a month, okay, of activity using this, and for an awful lot less capital. We don't need to build a steam plant. We don't need a lot of stuff, high-pressure steam and so forth, super-heated steam that we're putting into the bed. It's a very simple, easy, low-impact technology that can be used. Basically, you go down, you treat the bed, and then you suck the oil out of it is basically how it works.
So just like SAGD, I guess you'd have two wells that you have, or how many? Like, so would you have a well that would do the extraction, and then you'd have this tool in another well, or how do you access the formation?
You don't necessarily need two wells. You don't need. You could possibly design something that would use that, but basically the thing is, you can put the pumps down along with. You can put the pumps down in the same well as the ultrasonic tool, and you put a string down with both, let's say, five or six ultrasonic tools and different pumps along the lines and so forth to be able to access that. It would be, you could either do it continuously or you can just treat it for a few months until it liquefies the bed because it does not go back. Once you, probably with using steam will stay for a long time, but eventually, of course, it's going to cool. this technology, once it's liquefied, it stays liquefied, so that you can go and treat a fairly significant area in the bed, or volume rather, in the bed, and then start producing afterwards. So we could use maybe a huff and puff technique, or we might be able to form communications in an array. So you'd start with some beds would be basically ultrasonic wells, and other wells would be production wells, and get the oil to flow from one to the other if you could establish communication. Other ways of putting both pumps and tools down at the same time in the same bed or in the same well, and using it that way once you get it to flow and so forth. So there's different techniques you could use depending on the formation, depending on the situation. If you have vertical wells or horizontal wells. If we can get something like about 60 meters, we know that the sound will go 100 meters within the formation. So if we can get something where we can get communication across about 60 meters, we do not have to go horizontal. Maybe it would be better economically to do it vertically, because what you're looking at is just the wellhead at the top of the well. So it's a fairly low impact in what you're using.
So what does the commercialization process look like from a perspective of coming up with an idea and then actually patenting that idea and trying to bring it into commercial production?
Well, the path we took was basically we got our patents and intellectual property protection done almost immediately. It was the first thing we did. So we have a very early date or patent date. And we used provisional patents there, and then eventually through what's known as the PCT, which is a patent cooperation treaty, and then into a full patent, U.S. and Canadian patent. And we went with the U.S. patent route because we felt that was the best intellectual property protection we could get. Now, along the lines of doing that, you just have to go by hook or by crook with profit investment. That's the only way you can do it. There is a SHRED program, which is actually an excellent program, but that's basically tax refunds is what you're getting. That is a good assistance that helps Reader's County, but of course you have to spend the money first, and then at the end of the year you would claim back refunds and so forth on the spend or on the taxes and so forth you pay. But that's about all that there is as far as funding is concerned. Within the province, provincial funding such as Alberta Innovates and so forth, or within the federal government funding, they're not allowed to actually pay the inventor, the person who's actually doing the research. So, for example, if I am developing this technology, that is not an avenue I can take. So for myself and anyone else that's developing, you would have to basically knock on doors, find some sort of partner, either a financial partner or an investor who can deal with you, and then go out. We found an actual producing partner at the beginning. That way we were able to access wells, we were able to put something down hole, we were able to have a down hole test, which was phenomenal. We're very fortunate for that. We were able to do some testing afterwards. We've had other people pay us to test out their product, such as carbonates, on whether or not this will work with their product and what the recovery rate will be. And they pay us. That way we've been keeping going. We just finished coming back from a pilot to reduce the amount of condensate that's used in heavy oil. We think we can reduce the amount of condensate necessary by about 50%. That's what our results are showing, which is a huge cut. And we finished our research at this time. We finished. Like, we now know what we have. We've got engineered reports that basically have an engineering stamp on them. We've got third-party validation at this time. So at this time, where our spot is to start looking for actual investment capital and moving this towards a commercialization phase. So it's been 5 years we've been going on this phase. And to be honest, if you're going to do this, there's no such thing as having a great idea or a better mousetrap, going to some large company and they'll pay you a large sum of money and then you can retire. That may happen, but I haven't seen too much of that going. You have to work for it, and if you're willing to do the work, and basically scramble and tighten your belt for over an extended period of time, you can do that. And there are people out there that will help, such as other companies and so forth, that are in trouble, and you have to solve problems, you have to fulfill the needs that others have. And if you do that, you you're very lucky and you've got something that actually works, you can actually get ahead. So that's basically, I guess, in a nutshell, what you have to do. You actually have to, this is a bootstrap process, and if you know bootstrapping and you've studied bootstrapping, I think bootstrapping is the only way you can do it. I don't think there's any other way you could possibly do it. I don't think there's any funding out there that will support research into alternative technologies. Not to my knowledge, if anyone knows about it, I'd sure like to hear about it. As far as we've seen, the only thing you can do it is by literally by the seat of your pants and just basically bring the technology forward and find out areas where it can be used. And then by bootstrapping it in a step-by-step process or in staging your technology development, then you can get it basically to go.
Yeah, I have so much respect for that approach of just chasing that dream and basically doing everything that you can in order to achieve it. So it's interesting over time. My understanding is that PsychD was developed back in the late 70s / mid 80s and then it's been commercialized within the last 10 to 15 years. But what was the research focus like back at that time in comparison, I guess, to today from a research perspective focusing on new technology? Like what was it like to walk into the office, in 1981 at the Alberta Research Council, and what was that like?
Oh, that's an amazing question. There were some amazing people there. They're just truly amazing people, very gifted. You walk into the Research Council, you have two areas. One's a very nice building where most of the accountants and administrators are. Now at the back, because Clover Bar is where the dump is, and there's a mess of trailers, literally. Just trailers set, and they're all hooked up together and so forth. And it's quite cold, and you go and you plug your car in and so forth. You walk into this set of trailers. You got your office, a small office. Most people, everyone had their office. And the computer system you're using is from Clover Bar, about maybe 25 kilometers, 30 kilometers down to the University of Alberta, where the actual mainframe is. And you're using MTS, you're using Fortran. You're building your drivers to run your plotters. I wrote a driver and a Calcomp plotter and assembler. That's one of the things that we had to do. When we got there, the data itself was being recorded on a punch tape, and the punch tape itself had broken. So a lot of the data was, we had to sort of redo it. One of the things that I insisted we do is put in a tape drive, so at least we use magnetic tape to store. Because what you'd have to do, you had so much data that was coming in, it was not done on real time, it was done where we recorded it from a vast number of thermocouples and pressure transducers and so forth that are in the bags. We had two bags, and we would do one and then the other. Each run would take 2 or 3 days to go through, probably about at least an entire day and a half for each run. I would be trying different things one after the other. So you'd store the tape and then take the tape down to the university and then read it back in or try and get it that way. So we had to correct and number crunch basically the previous data and try and get that straightened out. And then we had to take new data to make sure that was in. And we had to design what is it that we're looking at. And a lot of times today you think that this stuff's just taken off the shelf and put it in. There was no software off the shelf that we had. You had to cut it yourself. You had to cut the entire thing yourself in Fortran. You'd have to design matrix manipulation and other things like that in the number crunching. Very hardcore, frontline mathematical research that was done. We were doing research into finite difference versus finite element in various types of numerical modeling. I was working at nonlinear differential equations, being able to put that into the mathematics we were looking at, so that the engineers basically could design and figure out which way to go with it, what was happening exactly in the bed. We got so good we could actually get sort of like a three-dimensional picture of the steam zone growing inside the bed itself, which I think was quite phenomenal. We had people, a lot of people from Chalk River. We had Russian scientists and Russian mathematicians working with us. We had people from Venezuela. We had people from Poland. We had people from all over the world were in that site, and it was a very intense, let's get her done research system with some like very real scientists, incredibly brilliant people who were quite dedicated in the work that they were doing, and a phenomenal spectrum, because when you're doing research like that, it's not like, oh, okay, we're going to pump steam into it and just get her out of the ground. Well, nobody's done this before. We have to figure out what we're doing. What does oil sand look like? We had, that oil sand was looked at under a scanning electron microscope with absolutely every property you could figure out to the thing. What parameters do we need? What everything is going in that way? And then regular meetings, presentations, papers, all sorts of things that are going on. And it was a real, it was a phenomenal experience. It was for 4 years there, from 79 up to 84, really 5 years, I guess. You know, just wonderful people to work with. Very cooperative, scientific way of looking at things. And it was actually pure science and pure research that was going on in trying to develop this. And if you want to know anything about oil sands, you've got to get the AOSTRA handbook that came out at that time. It's a very thick thing. It's a couple hundred bucks. I think you can get it on Amazon, or there may be some copies. I know there's a copy at University of Calgary. And it's got just about everything you want to know about oil sands is in there. It's already been done. And to work in that environment was an amazing, amazing environment. It was some remarkable people that we could work with. And if there were problems, like with mathematics, for example, with various techniques, or with computer programming with various different techniques, we'd sit around and share ideas and hack it out and stuff like that. So it was a very cooperative type of environment with different teams that were working back and forth. And a lot of it was completely ad hoc, which was really a very intense, creative way to do science. It was quite a remarkable experience.
It sounds like a really amazing place, I guess, to be, and really a world-leading, innovative environment where all these ideas were able to be tested. And just the thought of having to program your own drivers for building a 3D model of a bed formation in 1981, really, I can't even comprehend it. But what did it take in order to have that environment, present or create that environment, and how does that compare to the environment today?
Well, at that time, I'd say it took roughly about $2 million a month. That makes it easy to understand. I don't know how much. I think it was about $4 billion by the time they threw at that thing. So that's what it takes. And it took very good management. I remember a chap who was managing it by the name of Dan Prowse. Dr. Dan Prowse, who was an amazing man. He just could get it done. He was very sort of hands-on himself. He knew what he was doing, very knowledgeable. And I think Alberta, really owes a debt, as far as our knowledge is, to Dan, for being able to work extremely well with researchers. And he was the one who was responsible for setting up the environment. There's no shadow of doubt about it. So it takes, basically people say, what does it take, as though there's some magic formula, we dial the right buttons and stuff like that, we get a research environment. Research takes people. It's people that do research, not companies, and it's not organizations that do research. Research is done by human beings, and sometimes a guy who is so, or woman who is so intensely focused on a particular problem, they will just drive themselves day and night until that actual problem gets solved. Okay, that's the stage that is necessary. You need an environment where that's allowed to be able to do that. And we even went into research studying, like, what type of research teams do you need? Okay, and it was found the best thing is to have three people on a research team seems to be the best number. Okay, right down to that point, we were even looking at what type of background music would you need. We found Baroque music works best. Okay, that type of thing. I mean, not very much of that was done. It's very easy to, discuss that and take a look at it, because we could find that out. But with people from all over the world like that, with that type of cooperation, then we could really get down to it. But if you're trying to figure out, for example, how we're going to number crunch, or how we're going to find certain coefficients to curve fit, like a 21 variable or 21 order type of three-dimensional picture, so that we can actually get the thing to be drawn and things like that, you've got to figure out how to number crunch it. You've got to figure out. Then you have to sit down. You actually have to cut the code and things like that. You have to have the time to be able to do that. And just to get the idea to do it in the first place, because nobody knows, okay, what do you do? Well, let's see if we can take a picture of this. Well, how do we go about that? All of this takes time, okay? And all of this takes the freedom to be able to do that. And encouragement. You need encouragement from management to be able to yes, there are boundaries with what you have to do. There are some directions that we have to go in. But there has to be the freedom to have the sidebars, because out of those sidebars, that's where you'd be able to make your discoveries. That's where you get your secondary ideas and stuff like that, and they can be extremely, extremely valuable. So basically, I would say you got to find the right person. You got to find the right person to ride herd on it. You got to find the right people that have to be there. It's very much a people game, okay, with doing research with your team. We had about 35 scientists, I think, that were working there also from all over the world. And they were very, very brilliant people. So you have to, Dan Prowse was just amazing at working with us and being able to get us to work together, being able to, you know, make sure everything went smoothly and there were no problems, things like that. He would spot that. And he was quite excellent. So I would say mostly that's the guy who deserves a big pat on the back and the handshake is Dan for the work that he did. But that's what you need. You need someone who can do that. It's a people type of game. It's not something where you have a magic potion or a certain amount of money and just throw money at it and it'll be done. You have to actually take the time, make sure the money is spent correctly with as efficiently as possible. And at the same time, you have those kinds of freedoms. Get the right people in the room that can actually work together and be able to do it.
What does the research environment look like in Alberta today in comparison to that?
Right now, I'd say it's very corporate. Synovus is doing a lot of work, you know, for what they're doing, that they're looking for different technologies. We also see stuff that Schlumberger is doing. They have some labs somewhere where they're trying things out and so on. But there isn't that, I don't think there's that really, that freedom to be able to just try different things. I think right now it's been set down, the blinkers are on, and we're going down this road, and we're not going to deviate. This is where the investment money is. This is what we're trying to find, these parameters. So I don't think that there really is that fundamental type of research from the ground up that used to exist. I think those days are gone. I don't think we'll ever see them again. There are stuff that I think is quite courageous. I think this idea that EZ Energy did, it's a courageous move. And what Ansolvus does is Hatch Engineering, a great bunch of guys over there. But really, that's actually set down. I don't think it has the same spirit of what was tried before, because that was a laboratory experiment. The Research Council was an actual laboratory pilot project where you had a pilot plant and you were doing it that way under very, very controlled conditions and so forth before it got rolled out. And that takes money. That takes a lot of money. And at that time, that was where it was released to take that chance to do that investment. Was really good. Right now, it's completely, I think right now it's investment driven. Just try and get the return on the dollar. The big money, I don't think, is actually going into actually finding true alternative ways of doing things. So.
It's interesting your commentary in terms of the, the method of discovery that happened at the, was that research center at the University of Alberta that you were working with, where the oil sands, what was the actual name of it?
Okay, it's called the OSRD Center, the oil sands, Oil Sands Research Department, which is under the Alberta Research Council. And OSRA was an organization from the government that was a funding organization that was supplying money to the Oil Sands Research Department. Now, wasn't that the University of Alberta really had nothing to do with the University of Alberta? It was off in Clover Bar. Clover Bar is in the University of Alberta, is just south of the river, of course, 109th Street, or just west of 109th Street. Clover Bar is to the east of Edmonton itself, north of the river, by the dump there, and there's a large building, and they had a series of trailers that were in behind it, and it was pretty well isolated in the world unto its own, sort of once you got into the trailers. That was really where the action was. So physically, that actually were. Now, behind the trailers, there was a plant, basically a steam plant, that was taken over. That's why it was there, so that we could put in large pressure vessels and fill the pressure vessels with oil sand and start pumping steam into it. And there was some leftover steam that we could get. It was up to about 120 to 140 degrees C that we could inject, so superheated steam that we could inject into these beds and so forth. And it was an isolated research area that was a significant number of scientists. We also had technical people, steam engineers, other things like that were running it. So it was a pretty big operation.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to me is that I see some parallels in terms of some of the Silicon Valley startup kind of water technology companies, where a lot of the products that come out of individual initiatives of people working on an idea and not necessarily something where this is the direction we're going into. It's more of kind of like an inquisitive process of like, oh, you know, that's kind of interesting, and then working on further developing that. And so it's interesting to see the kind of the parallels there. And so I'd just like to try to, I know that I think that there's some real gold associated with your experience of really kind of the birthplace of the SAGD process, if you will, that happened at that facility. And so maybe you spoke earlier about how there was a lot of sharing, I guess, presentations and kind of collaborative working happening within the different research disciplines that were happening there. And so maybe, I don't know, I know it's a long time ago, but is it possible if you could bring us to one of those sharing sessions? I mean, what did it look like and what was it all about?
Basically, quasi-formal or semi-formal presentations you would put on, just much as we'd have today, sort of like on a seminar. Like you'd go do some work and then you'd say, okay, at the end of the week, let's say on a Friday or something like that, you'd have an afternoon and you would present to your colleagues and your peers work that you were working on, a paper that you might be wanting to put in, where you were within your technology. That way you could explain what your problems are, just where they are, maybe get some ideas, but basically you would continue on working on your work. And other people would have, so there would be that way of dealing with it. Another way would be hanging around in the offices together, talking about a particular problem, just ad hoc. That sort of thing was done. But I would probably venture that the research environment at Google was probably the same as the research environment for the Alberta Research Council in those days. It would be a very similar environment because it's kind of what it looks like. Research is research, and you know, the creative process is the creative process. And maybe you can think of a rock band getting together trying to build a new song. It's kind of the same thing. There'll be, you know, button heads, and they'll be trying to put something together, trying different things out, and so forth. So, you know, whether it's the arts or the sciences, probably, you know, this research and creative idea seems to be pretty well universal, and you just need the time and the place to be able to put something like that together. Places like Silicon Valley, you've got that environment. Places in Alberta, you don't have that anymore. You know, you used to, but you don't anymore. That's open, shut down. So, you know, looking at it, if that gives an idea wherever people get into a creative process where they're trying to build something as a team, you know, and put that together, it's going to be pretty well look the same to everybody.
Yeah, that's some really interesting insights, and I thank you for joining me here on the podcast. So, but before we finish, what's the best way for the listener in order to reach out and kind of get a hold of you?
Oh, well, thank you very much, Aaron. It's been great being here, and let me talk about, you know, some of the old days and stuff like that. If people want to get a hold of me, probably the best way is through my website, which is www.greennabr.com. And contact me there. I'm fairly easy to find on the internet. And that'll have my email on it. It's got my number and stuff like that. So if people want to know about it, they can go to my website, greennabr.com. And be able to get a hold of it that way.
Well, it's been so nice to get an insight into the oil sands of the past that really created the oil sands of the future, and also hearing your story of working to develop a unique extraction technology. So I really hope that in the future you're able to commercialize that technology. And thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Aaron. It's been great being here.
Thank you for listening all the way through to the end of episode 7. To check out our back catalog or just connect, head to oilsandtech.com. And so over the next couple months, we'll be hosting a meetup in Calgary, Edmonton, and Fort McMurray, and possibly even Houston. So you can check that out on the website. And thank you so much for listening.